quelled the Chinese mutiny. The friends of Dr. John Whipple were therefore apprehensive when the doctor took into his home the keys to serve as cook and maid, and men stopped him several times on the street to ask, "Do you think it wise, John, to harbor in your home such criminal characters?" "I don't find them criminal," Whipple responded. "After the mutiny?" "What mutiny?" he always asked dryly. "The one that Rafer Hawksworth put down on the Carthaginian." Dr. Whipple never openly refuted the captain's story, for he knew that what is mutiny to one man is not to another, and it was his nature to make generous allowances. But he often did observe sardonically, "Even very brave men sometimes see ghosts." He was content to have the keys working for him. On the day of their arrival, Dr. Whipple piled their luggage into his dray and then led his two servants on foot leisurely up Nuuanu Street toward his home, and although he could not speak Chinese, he explained the structure of the city to the young couple. "The first street we cross is Queen. Queen. Queen." He stopped and drew a little map in the dust and made them repeat the name of the cross street. At first, they failed to understand what he was doing. So deftly, he drew a ship and pointed back to the Carthaginian. And immediately they caught on, for it was Dr. Whipple's conviction that any man not an imbecile could be taught almost anything. "Merchant. King. Hotel," he explained. Then he left Big Nuuanu Street and took a detour to the corner of Merchant and Fort to show his Chinese the J&W store. "This is where I work," he said, and his servants were impressed, the more so when he picked up several bolts of dark cloth and handed them to Nyuk Tsin. Finally, he came to the broad east-west street named in honor of Great Britain, Baratania, and when he had taught the Chinese how to say that important name, he showed them that they stood on the corner of Nuuanu and Baratania. They understood, and then he pointed to a substantial picket fence that surrounded a large property on the ocean western corner, and when he had reviewed with them just where this stood, he opened the gate and said, "This will be your home." They smiled, three people with three different languages, and the Chinese looked in awe at the Whipple homestead. Set amid 3 acres of land, it was built on coral blocks and consisted of a large one-story wooden building completely surrounded by a very wide porch. All interior rooms were thus dark and cool and were accessible to the veranda. The coral base of the house was masked by luxuriant croton plants recently brought to Hawaii by the captain of an H&H ship, and these produced large, varicolored leaves, iridescent in rain or sunlight, so that the sprawling house nestled in tropic beauty. Dr. Whipple called, and from the front door his wife appeared, a small, white-haired New England woman wearing an apron. She hurried across the porch and onto the lawn, extending her hands to the Chinese. "This is my wife," Dr. Whipple explained formally, "and this is the cook, Mun Kai, and the maid, Mrs. Key." Everyone bowed, and Mrs. Whipple said, "I should like to show you to your new home," and she demonstrated how the Whipple dining room stood at the rear of the big wooden house, and how there was a covered runway from it to an outside kitchen where all the food was cooked, and another runway leading off to a small wooden house, and this was to be theirs. She pushed open the door and showed them a compact, clean room, which she herself had dusted that morning. Leading off from it was another. And while they stood there conversing, they knew not how, the dray arrived with their luggage and stores of food, utensils, and bedding. "These are for you," Mrs. Whipple said warmly, taking Nyuk Tsin's hand and leading her to the boxes. That afternoon, one of the Hewlett women asked, "Amanda, how will your Chinese learn to cook if they can't understand a word you say?" "They'll learn," Amanda replied forcefully, for she shared her husband's New England conviction that human beings had brains, So for the first 4 weeks of their employment, the Keys went to school. Little Amanda Whipple was up at 5, teaching Munkai how to cook American style. And she was impressed both with his clever mind and his fearful stubbornness. For example, on each Friday during the past 4 decades, it had been Amanda's ritual to make the family yeast. And for the first 2 Fridays, Munkai studied to see how she performed this basic function in American cookery. He watched her grate the potato into a stone jar of almost sacred age and add a little salt and a lot of sugar, after which she poured in boiling water, allowing all to cool. Then, ceremoniously, she ladled in 2 tablespoonfuls of active yeast made the Friday before, and the strain continued. For 43 years, Amanda had kept 1 family of yeast alive, and to it she attributed her success as a cook. She was therefore appalled on Munkai's 3rd Friday to enter the cookhouse full of ritualistic fervor, only to find the stone jar already filled with next week's yeast. With tears in her eyes, she started to storm at Munkai, and he patiently listened for some minutes, then got mad. Flashing his pigtail about the kitchen, he shouted that any fool could learn to make yeast in 1 week. He had been courteous and had studied for 2 weeks, and now he wanted her out of the kitchen. Not understanding a word he was saying, she continued to mourn for the lost yeast, so he firmly grabbed her shoulders and ejected her onto the lawn. On Monday, the new batch of yeast was as good as ever, and she consoled herself philosophically. It's the same strain sent forward by different hands. Suddenly, she felt the elderly, white-haired woman she was. Munkai also had difficulty understanding why Americans ate so much, and he would consistently omit dishes to which the robust appetites of the white men had become accustomed. A typical Whipple dinner, served at high noon in the heat of the day, consisted of fish chowder, roast beef with Yorkshire pudding, creamed cabbage cooked in ham fat, delicious chewy biscuits made of taro and drenched in butter, mashed potatoes, candied yams, pickled mango, alligator pear salad with heavy dressing, French bread with guava jelly, banana pie, marvelously thick and rich, followed by coffee with cream and cigars. If guests were present, 2 extra vegetables were served and French brandy. Later, the Chinese would eat steamed cabbage with no fat, a little fish cooked with soybean sauce, a bowl of rice and some unsweetened tea, and it was often remarked that Hawaii must agree with the Orientals, because even though they worked harder than the white men, they lived longer. When she finished supervising the preparation of food, little Amanda Whipple, in her 60s, turned her attention to Nyuk Tsin and taught the hard-working Chinese girl how to care for a large house. Dusting was particularly stressed and caused some difficulty, because in China, Nyuk Tsin's mother had waited for a likely omen before bothering to dust, whereas energetic Mrs. Whipple demanded that it be done regularly every day. The floors had to be dusted, the flowered china lamps, the chandelier, the rosewood love seat with its multiple curlicues, the endless embroidered decorations, the peacock chair from Canton, and the bamboo furniture that never looked clean. Nyuk Tsin's special nightmare was the great fishnet on the parlor wall, from which shells, leis, and other keepsakes were hung. In fact, there was scarcely an inch of the Whipple house that did not contain some gimcrack whose main purpose was gathering dust. In comparison, the Key household contained 1 table bearing the genealogy book, a flint lighter, a candle, and a wine bottle. There was also a rope bed above which hung the impressive sign, "May this bed yield 100 sons." According to the agreement reached by Whipple and his Chinese, Munkai received $2 a month, and his wife was to have received 50 cents. But when Mrs. Whipple saw how excellent Nyuk Tsin's work was, from 5 in the morning till 9 at night, 7 days a week, her generosity was touched. So she paid the girl a full $1 each month. and from this salary of $36 a year, the two Chinese were required to clothe themselves, pay for the birth and education of their children, provide for entertainment and luxuries, and send money home to the official wife in China. They did all these things, but their problems were eased a bit by the unnecessary generosity of the Whipples. Unexpected gifts here and there added to the family treasury, and the allotment of an acre of good land which Nyuk Tsin could farm for herself allowed the couple to earn some real money, for Nyuk Tsin was a fine farmer and soon appeared on the streets of Honolulu with a bamboo pole across her shoulders and two baskets of fresh vegetables slung from the ends. She hawked her wares mainly among the Chinese, accumulating from them a growing store of American dimes, Australian shillings, and Spanish reals, for Hawaii had wisely decided that any of the world's money could circulate freely within the kingdom. The key funds were further augmented by some shrewd enterprise on the husband's part, for each day, as soon as breakfast was finished, he hurried down Nu'uanu Street to Chinatown, where nondescript shacks huddled together in ugly profusion and where white men rarely went. His destination was a particularly disreputable hovel in which sat an elderly Chinese with wispy beard and a brush and book in which he entered bets as they were offered. Behind him, on the wall, hung a luridly colored sketch of a man with 28 parts of his body indicated: nose, ankle, knee, elbow. The game which had captured Meng Kai's whole imagination consisted of placing a bet as to which of these words would appear in the sealed capsule that stood under a glass on the table before the game's operator. Most of the Chinese in Hawaii played the game at odds of 30-1, which gave the player an advantage, except that if there were too many winners, the prize was proportionately lowered. The bank never lost. Nevertheless, the odds were enticing, and each day upon rising, families would inquire of one another, "Did you dream of an elbow last night?" Careful attention was also paid to any sudden pain or to an accident involving any part of the body. But mostly, it was dreams that brought good fortune, and it was uncanny how the dreams of Meng Kai kept pointing the way to the lucky word. "You here again with the winning word?" the game's manager asked sourly. "Today it's bound to be chin," Meng Kai assured him. "I woke last night with my chin itching furiously, and I can read through the glass and see the word written on the paper." "How much are you betting?"
"2 dimes.
The proprietor's face betrayed his displeasure as he brushed the entry into his book. "You're a clever man, Meng Kai," he grumbled. "Why don't you join me in this business?" "I'm a cook," Meng Kai replied. "It's better to win from you than work for you." "What I have in mind," the older gambler proposed, "is for you to collect bets at the far end of town and bring them in here by 10 each morning." "Then I couldn't bet for myself, could I?" Meng Kai asked. "No, then you'd be part of the game." From one of the towers along the waterfront, a clock struck 11. People crowded in from the alleys of Chinatown. The excitement grew intense, and the proprietor ceremoniously lifted away the glass to uncover the capsule. To prevent the quick substitution of a word on which no one had bet that day, a trick that had often been tried in the past, a man was selected at random, and under the most careful scrutiny he opened the capsule and shouted, "Chin!" Meng Kai leaped with joy and cried, "I had 2 dimes bet because I woke with a definite itch on my chin." He explained to everyone the precise minute at which he had wakened and his thoughts at that propitious moment. With his 2 dimes and his dream, he had won 2 months' normal wages. He was about to leave the gambling shack when the old proprietor caught his arm and said, "You ought to join me. Today you made a lot of money, but I make it every day." "You do?" Meng Kai asked. "Every day. If too many win, I cut the prize. I send hundreds of dollars back to China." "Could I?" the younger gambler asked. "Easily, if you worked with me."
It was in this way that the cookhouse of the missionary home at Nuuanu and Baratania became one of the principal outposts of the Chifa word game. Munkai kept on hand a supply of the gaudy posters which showed the 28 parts of the human body that might be named. And for each bet he took, he got 6% from the bank and 15% of the prize money from the winner if the ticket won. And he became one of the Chifa's best operators. For, as he had proved by paying the brothel operator full price for Nyuk Tsin, he was meticulously honest with both his employer and his customers. His chief return, however, came from his happy idea of having the Chifa poster printed in Hawaiian and in enlisting dozens of native gamblers. They enjoyed doing business with him and bought so many tickets that soon there were Chifa drawings both at 11 and at 4. With the money he made, Munkai slipped away two or three afternoons a week for the wild fantan and mahjong games that run uninterruptedly in Chinatown. He was a fierce competitor, and his store of dimes and reals and shillings grew steadily. The only disagreement the Keys had with the Whipples occurred when it became obvious that Nyuk Tsin was going to have a baby. For some months she had hidden the fact behind her loose smock, so that when Mrs. Whipple finally did discover it, she said, "You must do no more housework, Mrs. Key. Rest." But that same afternoon she saw Nyuk Tsin trudging down Nuuanu with two huge baskets of vegetables at the ends of her bamboo pole. Amanda stopped her carriage, climbed down, and commanded her maid to drop the burden and wait till Munkai could be sent to pick it up. But when the cook arrived, he studied the situation in astonishment and said, "Swinging the bamboo pole is the best thing a pregnant woman can do. It gets her ready." That night, Dr. Whipple went out to the Chinese house and said, "I'll make arrangements to deliver the baby." He was disturbed when Munkai explained in the little English he had picked up, "No need, doctor. I bring baby." It was a rather difficult point to argue, since neither man was proficient in the other's language, but Dr. Whipple got the distinct impression that Munkai was arguing, "In China, husbands always deliver their wives' babies. Who else?" "I think I'd better get an interpreter," the confused doctor interrupted. He went to fetch the scholarly man who served as unofficial Chinese consul and explained, "I'm afraid my servant here is intending to deliver his wife himself." "Why not?" the consul asked. "It's preposterous. I'm a doctor living right here." Then, fearing that perhaps money might be the problem, he assured the consul, "I'll do it without charge." Patiently, the consul explained this to Munkai, who was awed by the presence of an official and who wanted to avoid trouble. "My wife and I don't need the doctor," he said quietly. "Explain that there will be no charge," Whipple began, but he was interrupted by the consul, who, after listening to Munkai, explained, "If this man were in China, and if his other wife were pregnant, he would deliver her." "What other wife?" Whipple asked in bewilderment. "The wife here is only his number two wife. The real wife stays at home with the ancestors in China." "Do you mean to say—" Whipple spluttered. But again the consul interrupted to explain. "Munkai says that his uncle Chun Fat has three wives in China, two in California, and one in Nevada." "Does he also have children?" Whipple asked. There was some discussion of this, and Munkai reported, 7 in China, 4 in California, 2 in Nevada." "And did this uncle deliver all of his 13 sons?" Whipple snorted. "I'm sure they must have all been sons." "Of course," the consul replied blandly. "Of course he delivered them, or of course they were sons?" This confused the consul, and he suggested, "Maybe we had better start again." But Dr. Whipple had had enough. Pointing at Munkai, he snapped, "Do it your uncle's way. He seems to have had more experience than me." And he left. Working by himself, Munkai produced a fine boy, but everyone in the white community was outraged to think that the barbarous Chinese would follow such a custom. "And to think," one of the Hewlett girls cried, "all the time, not 50 feet away, there was one of the best doctors in Hawaii. Really, the Chinese are scarcely human." And it was generally agreed that for a stubborn man to insist upon delivering his own wife when practical, proved assistance from a real doctor was available, was proof that the Chinese were not civilized. The Whipples got another shock when they asked what the chubby, healthy little boy was to be called. "We haven't been told yet," Munkai replied. "How's that?" Whipple asked. Munkai said something about not yet having taken the poem to the store to find out what the child's name would be. Dr. Whipple started to ask, "What poem?" But he felt he'd better not and said no more about the name. But some days later, Munkai asked Mrs. Whipple if he and his wife could be absent for a few hours, and when Amanda asked why, he explained, "We must take the poem to the store to find out what the baby's name is." Mrs. Whipple called her husband and said, "You were right, John. The Keys are taking a poem to the store so as to get a name for their baby." "I'd like to see this," Dr. Whipple said, for such things were of concern to him. And Munkai said he would be honored to have such a distinguished man assisting at the naming of his first son. But before they started to the store, Whipple asked, "Could I see the poem?" And from the precious genealogical book, Munkai produced a card containing the poem from which all names in the great Key family were derived. It was an expensive, marbled, parchment-like cardboard, bearing in bold poetic script 14 Chinese characters arranged vertically in 2 columns. "What is it?" Whipple asked, his scientific curiosity aroused. But Munkai could not explain. The Chinese store to which the trio headed stood at the corner of Nu'uanu and Merchant Streets and was known simply as the Punti Store, for here that language was spoken and certain delicacies favored by the Punti were kept in stock. The storekeeper, an important man in Honolulu, recognized Dr. Whipple as a fellow tradesman and ceremoniously offered him a chair. "What's this poem my cook is talking about?" Whipple asked. Whereupon the Punti said, "Not speak me, him, him." And he pointed to a scholar who maintained a rude office in the corner of the store, where he wrote letters in Chinese and English for his Punti clients. Gravely, the letter writer picked up the poem and said, "This belongs to the Key family. From it they get their names." "What's it say?" "That's not important. This one happens to read, 'Spring pervades the continents, Earth's blessings arrive at your door. The heavens increase another year, and man acquires more age.'" "What's it got to do with names?" Whipple asked. "The answer is very complicated and very Chinese," the scholar replied. "But we are very proud of our system. It is probably the sanest in the world." "Can you explain it?" Whipple asked, leaning forward in his chair. "In China, we have only a few family names. In my area, less than 100, all one syllable, all easy to remember: Lum, Chung, Yip, Wong. But we have no given names like Tom or Bob." "No names?" Whipple asked. "None at all. What we do is take the family name, Ki, and add to it 2 ordinary words. They can be anything, but taken together they must mean something. Suppose my father were a Ki and believed that I would be the beginning of a long line of scholars. He might name me Ki Chung Fei, Ki Spring Glorious. That's the kind of name we seek for your cook's boy." "Where does the poem come in?" Whipple pressed.